So I was driving home from Milton one fall, and everyone was telling me to be careful of the moose. There were a lot of moose on the highway. I've never seen a moose in my life. It was my turn to drive. We were driving late. My husband was kind of asleep. I was listening to Tom Waits. And you know when you hit a song that you can't sing along to because it's just out of your range, or you don't like the words, so you, like, you know, you just... I miss entire songs because I don't like singing to them. But anyway, I'd been watching for moose because I'm terrified. Like, you don't want to hit a moose because you don't survive if you do, I don't think. Or you can, but it's horrible. But anyway, I just reached down to change the song. Like, sorry, Tom, not that one. And I looked up, and there was this creature in front of my car. Have you ever seen a moose? They're so huge. It's like, who invented that? And so, you can imagine. So, you know, like, if you survive something like that and you're a poet, you think, material, right? Like, yes, I nearly hit a moose. Excellent, I have a nearly hit a moose poem. So, here it is. It's pathetic how often I think material when my life goes really shitty. It's like, well, worst case scenario, I get a poem out of this. Anyway, sacrifice. The light of the moon ricochets off the bulrushes and projects itself into a moose. Your foot on the brake is doing mouth to mouth. Come on, the minute is overweight and sweaty. All you see is a wonderment of nonchalance. This beast has swallowed the woods and is transporting them across the highway. You hunch, convinced you could drive under it. You hunch because you're facing something both horny and holy. Doesn't everything important start with that same impulse? Your heart in the passenger seat needs its asthma pump. Have you seen its asthma pump? Your heart in the booster seat kicks at the back of your seat. Are we there yet? The night is looking out the window at its own reflection. You call out to your angels. You pray for giant cartoon hands to pull this moment from its bones. This is how you were raised. Desperate. You are not in good shape, and now you are skidding. Up close, the moose is an elegance of scraggle, and you succumb to die with this new idea of beauty. The car is a curtsy before everything wild on a trespass of highway, and you are the chosen apology. Your hands loosen. When you look back up to it, it's no longer there. And days later, was it ever? One more from this book. The last section deals more with outside the city, kind of the real outskirts, both emotionally, I'd say, spiritually, and geologically, geographically. So I'm thinking the second part is more about things like kind of how darkness is endangered. The title poem was essentially written after we went looking for a dark enough spot to watch the falling stars, and every dark street we turned down, security lights would come on, and we couldn't see the stars for the lights in the city. I've read this in places, and I get rural guys coming up going, "You want darkness? Come to my house," which maybe they're trying to pick me up, or maybe it's true, but around the city, it's hardly ever, there's no dark places anymore, and that astounds me. This last lamp starts with a quote by Paul Celan. Do not be deceived. This last lamp does not give more light. The dark has only become more absorbed in itself. Like the deer running erratic in the mall, the dark is out of breath. It's not that you're chasing it, more like holding up torches and threatening to. It's good weather for a witch hunt, and you don't trust it, do you? This last lamp is held up to examine the dark tongue of animal. What has it eaten, and how does it talk? This last lamp is a miner down the long throat of midnight. Your father sits with his thermos, his legs not being what they used to be. Go on without me, he says. And you do. What choice do you have but to strike his gentle words like a match? The only thing that burns is the lonely hour without him. Ah, grown up, how do you tell the time? There is a wolf in your memory. When you wake, you see it running with something in its mouth. Save the children, your wife screams, and you get out of bed and start the car before realizing it was only a dream. The children are long gone. The stilt of their shadows, a high-rise towering over the rural plot you've become. You, a scruff of ragweed and thistle. Remember your plans and the candle you called yourself. I thought I'd read... How am I for time? I've got one, two more poems? I'm going to read two poems, because that's all the time I have, and that's good. My next book is coming out actually next year by Gaspereau Press. I'm really excited. And it's just a weird collection of poems about the ocean. In Halifax, when you walk downhill, every street faces the ocean. And it's kind of like a big wolf or a coyote. It's a wilderness that you never get around. And during hurricane seasons, its waves get really big and wash out roads. And people think, oh my God, the ocean's crazy. It's an interesting thing to live next to because we can't control it. And it's beautiful and wild. And it's the most full... The most accurate full-length mirror I've ever encountered. If I'm having a bad day and I face the ocean, I'm delivered back to myself in a way that's both humbling and proper. So I really like living near the ocean. I think I would really grieve it if I wasn't around it. So this whole collection I wrote is about reckoning being near the ocean and treating it like a wild beast. So the poems are strange and they don't have titles, but I'll just read you one to give you an idea. The harbor didn't like being held captive by the shadows of our buildings. We treated it well, but it still, its dorsal fins weakened and flopped. The tide was nothing more than a sleepy scratch of water up over rocks and then a yawn back down. The balls we threw to it sank. It stopped slurping. It stopped nibbling. It hardly growled. Some days it looked like a carpet, other days a flooded campsite, discs of paper plates, lipstick, cigarette butts, the wet embers of our vacations. What was the fun of these skyscrapers if the only view we had was a petulant body of water? We bought fish from the market to feed it. The older women crocheted the most tender dialogue skimmed from our dreams, carrying Afghans by the armload down to its shore. In this way, they invented nets and managed to catch the grid of starlight from previous nights. With the right amount of sugar and boiled darkness, we soon had vats of the nectar so potent it bubbled. It wasn't that we got drunk, but forgetful, and became so greedy for more, we overfished our dreams for their tenderness. When poverty arrived, we were down to the bones of our talk. If we rubbed two sticks together, briefly, we'd be nourished by the smell of their wood. So, ocean. And the other poems I've been working on, and I'll just read, this is the last poem I'll read. When I was in New York, I got to go to the Alexander McQueen fashion show, and I was really impressed by fashion design. And I've been thinking a lot about privacy in public and how what we wear sometimes gives people a clue on how we're feeling. If we're grieving, we often wear black, and I like thinking a lot about that moment where public and privacy kind of trespass or meet or overlap. And I was in a position, my first husband died quite young, and I had to go to the funeral, and I didn't know what to wear or where to sit. It was really strange. I was like kind of an invisible widow because I'd been married to him for several years, but no longer, and he had since married someone else, and she was properly and truly grieving. And I needed something to wear, and I thought I could design something in a poem. And so I started designing clothes and poetry. And this is what I'm working on now. So this is a really new poem. And this is called Grief Wear. And I just want to thank you for listening. Listening to poetry, it's a potent way of using the language. And I appreciate how active you've been listening. It's been really nice to be here and having such a nice silence. Grief Wear. My first choice was an aspen from the third week of August, so its leaves were both green for the love I had borne, with a complement of the eventual yellow that is distinct and his. We had burned leaves in our youth, and in the smoke decided to marry. Remember the moon, I'd ask, but by then we picked out ceilings to match the curtains, and the sky was something we heard when it occasionally drove by an open window. There was, however, no time to find an aspen, he had died that quickly, and in April, short of forsythia, there's barely anything to suit the kind of winter wardrobe an unexpected death requires. The simple choice would have been something coniferous, but it was more complicated than that. I was his first wife, and protocol leaned more towards cedar than pine. His new bride could wear the mountain hemlock, the noble fir of the first pew, but I sat behind all of the years without him and barely cast a shadow. I wore gloves so when I touched his voice, I wouldn't smudge his obituary. I have kept very little and do not feel the need for purse or clutch. I have laundered memories so often they whisper and barely embroider. Handkerchiefs I now weep into for the younger version of myself who came to a forest whenever I saw him. And for our children. Our children. They chose slender antennas and a translucent shock to wear. When they entered the church, they both quivered, the way siblings so often telegraph. The ocean was worn pleated behind them for later, when they both will feel drowned. Thank you so much for listening.